This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
This is Press Watch, a weekly counter-propaganda and left opinion program. I'm Teresa Mitchell. Join me for the news you're not supposed to know. Starting with this morning, there is news that Israel is saying that they have intercepted a drone off the Haifa coastline. There was a drone in October from Hezbollah, and I believe last April, Israel had sent a drone over Hezbollah in Lebanon. This from Xinhua Chinese News. An Israeli Air Force F-16 fighter jet downed a drone off the coastline of the northern city of Haifa at noon today. That would be local time. The drone has apparently made its way into Israel's airspace from the north. When I say local time, I mean local Jerusalem time. They write, the drone is believed to have been operated by Hezbollah. Meanwhile, they say Lebanese media outlets reported that Israeli Air Force aircraft have been spotted over southern Lebanon. Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu, who is visiting the Druze community up north, said the IDF was prepared for any challenge. He said, quote, "We are tracking this issue with great concern in light of what is happening in Syria and Lebanon," end quote. Now, looking at departing from that and looking at the Lebanese and Israeli media, I didn't find anything in Lebanese media about Israeli Air Force aircraft. It could be that I did not look at the right ones. This is just news that is just breaking in the last hour or so. Israeli media is saying that Netanyahu. Well, I'm not sure which Israeli official right now, but possibly Netanyahu was midair at the time. They're making a big deal out of this, so this is something to watch. I have written an article on Portland Indie Media called KBOO Plans to Destroy Its Own Union. And I urge you to look it up. Right now I'm going to try not to talk about it on the air, but I'm very upset about the situation here. That's portland.indymedia.org. I wrote it anonymously to thwart the knee-jerk ad hominem attacks. And I'm glad to say that tactic has been successful. And I will be exposing more about this on Portland Indie Media. And there's a great deal of organization about this. So I urge you to read that article on portlandindymedia.org. KBOO plans to destroy its own union? Now, returning to international news, an article in the Christian Science Monitor states that a recent scientific study, including tree rings and carbon dating, shows the 20th century reversed a multimillennial cooling trend on our planet. Quoting, on millennial timescales, the cooling trend was statistically significant on all continents except North America, where the cooling was weaker, according to the study. Over the period the study covers, the cooling was driven variously by volcanic activity, which pumps light-reflecting aerosols high into the atmosphere, subtle changes in Earth's orbit, subtle changes in the amount of light the sun was emitting at the time, and land use changes, the researchers say. The relative influence of each factor varied depending on location. The medieval warming period, which the team pegs at between 830 and 1110 AD, encompassed the northern hemisphere at that time, while in the southern and southwestern Pacific, South America and southwestern Pacific, a period of relatively sustained warmth ran from 1160 to 1370. Now, injecting my opinion here, this is a refutation of the anti-global warming crowd, saying that the medieval warming period is proof that this sort of thing comes and goes. That was based on too little data. The study I'm referring to is much larger in scope and covers both northern and southern continents. And it shows, like everything else coming out of corporate America trying to trying to fool you into not saving the planet. It is so much hooey. Now, returning to the text, they write, The cooling trend first appeared to take hold in the Arctic, Europe, and Asia between 1200 and 1500 AD. North America felt it too, but less intensely, the study suggests. By late 1500s, the cooling had expanded to include Antarctica. That came as a surprise, one of the researchers says. The progression of cooling from north to south is a pattern one would expect to see from the combined effects of subtle changes in Earth's orbit and changes in its tilt, he explains. That cooling in the north came in part as the Arctic received less sunlight over a given surface area in the summertime. But that should also lead to more sunlight per square meter in Antarctica. In addition, changes in the sun's output and other sources of natural forcings on climate appear to have been far less influential at the time in Antarctica than over the northern hemisphere's continents. Now, once again, departing from that text, this is another thing that the corporate global warming deniers will throw up, that Antarctica has been cooling here and there. It has, and that is for complex thermodynamic reasons. Not all that complex. If you look into it, you can figure it out. But returning to the text, cooling was not as pronounced there, meaning in Antarctica, as it was in the Arctic region, but the evidence that cooling happened at all represents a new puzzle for researchers to solve. The team also notes that its reconstruction indicates that the medieval warming period and later the Little Ice Age were not global events, as some have claimed, but climate excursions whose timing and intensity varied by region. After 1900, warming hit all continents except Antarctica. The bottom of the world continued to cool. It's a trend other researchers attribute to the slow pace of temperature changes in the frigid moat of a southern ocean that surrounds the ice-encrusted continent. And high-altitude winds that encircle the continent have intensified, keeping cold air trapped at high southern latitudes. That's how it's done, actually. Now, changing the topic, an international team of experts has concluded an investigative mission to China with both sobering and encouraging findings about H7N9, a novel avian influenza virus recently found for the first time in humans. This is from sciencemag.org. Quoting Keiji Fukuda, Assistant Director General for Health Security of the World Health Organization, he says, "This is an unusually dangerous virus for humans." From what is known so far, he added, H7N9 is more easily transmissible from poultry to humans than H5N1, the avian influenza virus that has circulated in poultry in Asia for more than a decade, occasionally causing human fatalities. Calling it an avian influenza virus is not quite accurate, but that's all right. I'll go ahead with more from this article, as I was saying, from sciencemag.org. The team also reported that the available evidence points to live bird markets as being the most likely pathway for the virus from poultry to humans. Positive samples have been retrieved from poultry and from contaminated surfaces at the markets. Nancy Cox, a flu expert at Centers for Disease Control and Prevention in Atlanta, cautioned that while it is still early, we can now understand the likely source of infection is poultry, that the virus originates from poultry, end quote. I apologize for my emotions. It's very difficult for me to do this broadcast. But I repeat, please turn to portland.indymedia.org. You're listening to Press Watch. I'm Teresa Mitchell. This is KBOO Portland. This is still KBOO Portland Community Radio. Returning to the article, as of 23rd of April, H7N9 had affected 108 people, causing 22 deaths, according to the World Health Organization. That total does not include the first case outside mainland China, confirmed by the Centers for Disease Control in Taipei late this afternoon, local time. The patient is a Taiwanese citizen who fell ill 3 days after returning to Taiwan from Jiangsu province, the site of several confirmed H7N9 cases. Like many H7N9 victims, he cannot recall any contact with poultry. So there's more on that article from sciencemag.org. Looking at that and other articles about H7N9, I would say it is not yet a problem, but it most certainly is an indication of how fierce influenza can be, because it has about a 19%+ fatality rate in known cases so far, which is just extreme. Probably the actual fatality rate is somewhat somewhat lower. And you will also find more information on this at Recombinomics.com, which is Dr. Henry Nyman's website. You may recall Dr. Henry Nyman from his broadcast here on this show on KBOO. The violence is worsening in the U.S. invasion and occupation of Afghanistan, and war generally is threatening globally. But in Afghanistan, well, this from the Los Angeles Times. An article by Emily Alpert, Afghanistan has suffered a troubling rise in killings of civilians, with the figure surging almost 30% in the first 3 months of the year. According to a United Nations envoy, despite the sobering statistic, the U.S. military commander in Afghanistan said Wednesday that other facts highlighted the improved security across the country, involving dramatic increases in the number of children in school and the share of Afghans who have access to health care. That's the sort of crap that they print in the LA Times. And I think that should be followed by the fact that the U.S. military commander often says junk like that, but it isn't followed by that. It's followed by this sentence. The death toll is being closely watched because Afghan forces are slated to take over responsibility for securing the country ahead of departure of most foreign troops in 2014. The latest figures were released as Afghanistan faces the seasonal resurgence of heavier fighting triggered by warmer weather that eases militants' movements through mountain passes. Jan Kubis, the U.N. Special Envoy to Afghanistan, according to LA Times, told NATO foreign ministers meeting Tuesday in Brussels that he was particularly troubled that the Taliban had declared courthouses and their personnel targets. Attacks this month on a courthouse and government offices in western Afghanistan were nothing less than a war crime, he said. and there's not a word about drones so far in this article. But you can find it at Los Angeles Times. This is the sort of thing that Emily Alpert writes in the Los Angeles Times. And it's a big reason why the U.S. population goes along with invading and occupying a foreign country without justification. And this is a big reason why President Obama has given a pass on this sort of thing after his tripling and then reduction of forces in Afghanistan. And the ongoing drone attacks, as you may have heard earlier on KBOO, on Democracy Now!, drone attacks that wipe out entire villages. I have some information. I was going to pass on an article about Syria from Al Jazeera that starts, the U.S. says it will not be rushed into a verdict over whether Syria has used chemical weapons just because other countries believe evidence supports that conclusion. Defense Secretary Chuck Hagel said late on Wednesday at the end of a visit to Egypt that included talks about Syria and other regional issues that decisions on such serious business could not be decided on a timeline. Suspicions are one thing, evidence is another, Hagel said. We have to be very careful here before we make any conclusions, draw any conclusions based on real intelligence. Hagel said he was not questioning other nations, Israel's intelligence, but the United States relied on its own intelligence. The U.S. has warned that any chemical weapons used by Syria would cross a red line that would trigger an unspecified response. Well, there's new information on that. Hagel has had his leash yanked, and the new article from Agence France-Presse is Syrian regime forces have probably used chemical weapons on a small scale, U.S. Defense Secretary Chuck Hagel told reporters in the UAE today, citing U.S. intelligence agencies. Hagel said the White House had sent a letter to several members of Congress saying the U.S. intelligence community assesses with some degree of varying confidence that the Syrian regime has used chemical weapons on a small scale, end quote. The United States has already warned that any use or transfer of chemical weapons in Syria would cross a red line and could trigger military action. So I guess departing from that, well, that's the end of the Agence France-Presse article. I suppose if they're saying that the Syrian regime has used chemical weapons on a small scale, does that mean the U.S. will attack them on a small scale? War intensifying. The U.S. global oil hegemony war is what I'm talking about here. But returning to the article that was up to date just as of a couple of hours ago and no longer is up to date, Hagel rejected suggestions that the U.S. was undermining its credibility by saying it was continuing to assess the issue. Back and forth, but so far forth. The Syrian government and rebels each accuse the other of launching a chemical attack near the embattled city of Aleppo last month. Syrian authorities acknowledged last year having chemical and biological weapons and said they could be used if foreign countries intervened in the conflict. Excuse me. And as you may have heard, the minaret in the mosque in Aleppo that marked the grave of the father of John the Baptist has been blown up. And each side is accusing the other of having done that. Going to the situation in Iraq, the post-invasion civil war has again broken out in Iraq. This from the Telegraph from the UK. Four soldiers died and at least eight others were killed when gunmen took over police headquarters in the town of Suleiman Beg and then deployed on the streets. On social media, their supporters dubbed the dusty roadside settlement as the first liberated city in Iraq. Further north, at least 10 Iraqi policemen and 9 Sunni Islamist militants were killed in clashes in Mosul, where guerrilla fighters used a mosque loudspeaker to rally fellow Sunni Muslims to battle. The attacks, which are likely to lead to further violence as security forces attempt to reclaim lost ground, follow several days of fighting that has claimed the lives of up to 128 people. Last night, the country's Shia Prime Minister, Nuri al-Maliki, warned that the gunmen wanted to take the country back to sectarian civil war. The violence, the fiercest since U.S. troops left Iraq at the end of 2011. I'm sorry, but I'll have to stop there and say, U.S. troops left. You put that in quotation marks. There is a giant occupation palace at the center of Baghdad, which we laughingly call the embassy. It is full of mercenaries, special forces, and of course there is U.S. air power still in Iraq. So, sorry, we're still at a war. We're still at war with Iraq. Returning to the article, the violence first flared on Tuesday when security forces sought to move anti-government protesters from a camp near the town of Hawija, near the oil-rich city of Kirkuk, sparking clashes that left 53 people dead. Oil-rich. They write, trouble then spread across Sunni-dominated northern and central Iraq, culminating in the fall of Suleiman Beg, an otherwise unremarkable market town 90 miles north of Baghdad. In some areas, militias commanded by powerful local tribal sheikhs erected checkpoints. The Iraqi military claimed the protests had been infiltrated by the Naqshbandiya army, a band of Sunni militants loyal to the late President Saddam Hussein, whose fall in 2003 ended nearly a century of Sunni dominance of Iraq. Once again, departing from the Telegraph article, telegraph.co.uk, if you want to read the whole thing, the Sunnis were set against the Shia in a clever and vicious campaign by U.S. special forces who would dress as either faction and then go blow up the mosques. U.S. special forces dressed as Sunnis would go to Shia mosques and blow them up. U.S. special forces dressed as Shia would go to Sunni mosques and blow them up. Did I just say that twice? Pardon me, but you get the point. Returning to the article, yesterday the mayor of the city of Tulz Hormatu, which administers Suleiman Beg, said that while gunmen were still in control of the town, the army was besieging it, and there had been sporadic clashes. He says, we withdrew tactically so we can work on clearing the area completely. So things are looking pretty bloody in Iraq right now. Now switching the war's focus to the Koreas. Excuse me. You're listening to Press Watch, by the way, on KBOO Community Radio, KBOO Portland, KBOO 90.7 FM. And it's 9:22, getting on to 9:23, Thursday morning, 25th of April, 2013. This from the Edmonton, Canada Journal. The move, South Korea issued an ultimatum today to North Korea over a shared industrial complex, Yongbyon. The move increases pressure on Pyongyang, even as delegations of old soldiers from Commonwealth countries finish tours of their former battlefields. Tension on the divided peninsula has been simmering for weeks, with the South warned of grave consequences with the continued closure of the sprawling factories at Kaesong. South Korea set Friday as a deadline for talks on the future of the joint venture. North Korea, early this month, blamed South Koreans for banned North Korea early this month barred South Koreans from crossing the border and entering the factory, and later withdrew the 53,000 northern workers who operate the assembly lines. The complex is owned and managed by South Korean companies, but employs northern workers and has been idle for a month in a protest by Pyongyang over increasing United Nations sanctions. And just adding my part to this article, also, and mostly, in a protest by Pyongyang over the very threatening U.S. war games called Full Eagle, involving thousands upon thousands of soldiers and military weapons of various kinds, naval and air and land. So there's more on that article at the Edmonton Journal. And now changing to the war on you, Matthias Cheng writes in Global Research that should the U.S. decide to follow Cyprus' lead in the upcoming cash crisis, the upcoming post-derivatives crash crisis, your deposits will be at risk. He writes, the moment you deposited your money with the bank, the ownership is transferred to the bank. Your status is that of a creditor to the bank, and the bank is in law a debtor to you. You are deemed to have lent your money to the bank for the bank to apply to its banking business, even to gamble in the biggest casino in the world, the Global Derivatives Casino. You have become a creditor, an unsecured creditor. Therefore, by law and the insolvency of a bank, you as an unsecured creditor stand last in the queue of creditors to be paid out of any funds and or assets which the bank has to pay its creditors. Now, departing from that text, the first thing that you're likely to think if you paid attention in high school is that, oh, wait, the FDIC insures my deposits. But as I've mentioned several times on this show, the FDIC has been fatally compromised by Bank of America's derivatives. What? They're not allowed to do that, you say. Ha, says Bank of America. Anyway, the secured creditors are always first in line, writes Matthias Cheng, to be paid. It is only after secured creditors have been paid and there are still some funds left, usually not much, more often zilch, that unsecured creditors are paid and the sums prorated among all the unsecured creditors. This is the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, he writes. The law has been in existence for hundreds of years and was established in England by the House of Lords in the case Foley v. Hill in 1848. When a customer deposits money with his banker, I've got to depart from the text already. Do you have money in a bank? If you do, why? There are wonderful credit unions in this region. Please move your money to a credit union. It is insured by a separate government entity. I can't really say whether that one's absolutely sound, but I can say the FDIC is well screwed, technically speaking. That's a scientific term. Returning to the article, when a customer deposits money with his banker, the relationship that arises is one of creditor and debtor, with a banker liable to repay the money deposited when demanded by the customer. Once money has been paid to the banker, it belongs to the banker, and he is free to use the money for his own purpose. And Cheng writes, I will now quote the relevant portion of the judgment of the House of Lords, handed down by Lord Cuttenham, the Lord Chancellor. In 1848, he stated thus, money, when paid into a bank, ceases altogether to be the money of the principal. It is then the money of the banker, who is bound to return an equivalent by paying a similar sum to that deposited with him when he has asked for it. The money paid into the bankers is money known by the principal to be placed there for the purpose of being under the control of the banker. It is then the banker's money. He is known to deal with it as his own. He makes what profit of it he can, which profit he retains himself. Quoting further from Lord Cottenham, and this is from the article in globalresearch.ca. By the way, if you're trying to follow that, the common mistake is to try to put in globalresearch.com. Doesn't work. Globalresearch.ca. And the money placed in the custody of the banker is, to all intents and purposes, the money of the banker to do with as he pleases. He is guilty of no breach of trust in employing it. He is not answerable to the principal if he puts it into jeopardy, if he engages in a hazardous speculation. He is not bound to keep it or deal with it as the property of the principal. All right, I've had my say. I hope to be back next week. Again, I direct you to portland.indymedia.org, where I have anonymously written an article. You'll find it in the roll on the right of the page, portland.indymedia.org. KBOO plans to destroy its own union? Yeah. Stay tuned. There is more of KBOO Community Radio, I'm glad to say. We'll be right back.
KBOO Community Radio continues the broadcast of the 2013 Illihi Lecture Series on Wednesday, May 8th, when we'll broadcast a talk by Jeffrey Clements.
An attorney and author, Jeffrey Clements is the co-founder of Free Speech for People, a national, nonpartisan campaign challenge, the creation of constitutional rights for corporations, overturn Citizens United versus FEC, and strengthen American democracy and self-government. Clements is the author of Corporations Are Not People.
Jeffrey Clements will be speaking at the First Congregational Church in Portland, and KBOO will broadcast the talk live at 7 p.m. Wednesday, May 8th. More information can be found at kboo.fm/Illihi2013.
Good day, and thank you for tuning in to KBOO and A Deeper Look. I'm your host, Linda Olson-Osterlund. Our topic today is drones and kill teams, the United States' secret wars around the world. My guest today is Pulitzer Prize-winning New York Times journalist Mark Mazzetti, author of the just-released book, The Way of the Knife, The CIA, A Secret Army, and A War at the Ends of the Earth. With a master's degree from Oxford, Mark Mazzetti has reported for The Economist, U.S. News and World Reports, and Los Angeles Times before joining the New York Times, where he's reported since 2006. And he's won a lot of awards along the way. His new book takes us through the post-9/11 reshaping of the United States military and the U.S. intelligence agencies, the CIA from intelligence gathering around the world to running drones and kill teams, and the Pentagon from traditional troop-bound warfare to drones and kill teams. In town to talk about his book and joining me here in the KBOO studios, welcome Mark Mazzetti.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Yeah, thank you very much for joining us. Mark, in your book, you give us a sort of firsthand inside account of some of the conflicts inside both the Bush and Obama administration as it made this transformation that many of us can now see very plainly. From one kind of army and espionage activities to a totally new shaping of the way our military, our military / intelligence organizations operate. Give the overview to people, and what were the conflicts? Who were the conflicting players?
Well, if you date it back right to the September 11th attacks, you have the CIA given lethal authority by President Bush right after the attacks to go around the world and capture or kill al-Qaeda operatives. So this is a thing that the CIA hadn't really done for decades. The CIA had been out of the killing business for some time.
Many of us remember they were in the killing business, Latin America and other places. In the past.
No, there was certainly so you have these different waves of CIA activity. You have the early days with the coup plots and the assassination attempts up to the mid-70s when the Church Committee hearings aired out a lot of this dirty laundry, and President Ford signed an assassination ban in 1976. So and then, of course, in the 80s, you had some of the covert wars in Latin America as well. But it was not the CIA doing this direct manhunting and killing that you really have seen since 9/11. The early days of the CIA's activities were more focused on interrogation, detention, as we all well know, in secret prisons. Eventually, it became much more into targeted killing. So you've seen this evolution of the CIA into this paramilitary force. On the other side, in the military side, if you looked at 9/11, you had Donald Rumsfeld, the defense secretary, who looked at what he inherited on 9/11, and he saw this military that he thought was totally ill-equipped to deal with the kind of war he wanted to fight. So there were restrictions on where soldiers could go. His special operations forces were fairly small, didn't have big budgets. Teams like the SEAL Team 6 and the Delta Force could do 24-hour, 48-hour operations, but nothing more than that. He sort of had this epiphany that he needed to fight a war around the world. And that led him to push to expand the Pentagon's intelligence gathering activities, human intelligence, putting soldiers on the ground in places where soldiers normally didn't go to spy, to kill, to all these things. So you saw this convergence over the last 10, 11 years between what the CIA does and what the Pentagon does.
And the conflicts have really been pretty tremendous between the CIA and the Pentagon at different times. And in fact, they've had overlapping operations that both didn't know about. Is that correct? And a lot of funding that has been put into both of them with no oversight.
Right. I mean, if you have both the CIA and the Pentagon, each answers to different parts of Congress, so each congressional committee. So there's been times when one would be doing one and telling their part of Congress or their committee. The other would sometimes tell their committee. The committees wouldn't talk to each other. There was just as little communication between various congressional committees in order to perform oversight as there was between the CIA and the Pentagon themselves. So what does that really mean? What's the implication? The implication is what was happening in the early to mid part of the last decade was you would have military spies going into countries, not telling the American ambassador, not telling the CIA station chief. They would be sort of running into each other. They were trying to be recruiting the same sources. You had teams that Rumsfeld sent to places like Paraguay, where one team was sent to an embassy to gather intelligence and ended up having to get spirited out of the country very quickly after two of them got into a bar fight and one of them pulled a gun. So it was some haphazard activity. And then in about 2005 and 2006, I write about in one chapter how they tried to get together and sort of what they ended up in fact doing was carving up the world where they said, okay, the CIA is going to be in charge here, the Pentagon's going to be in charge here. So you saw more collaboration, but then in also places where, like for instance in Yemen today, you also have redundancy where you have the CIA running a drone war.